Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome a fellow surgeon, Mr. Giles Bond-Smith. Mr. Bond-Smith works as a consultant hepatobiliary and emergency general surgeon in Oxford at the Oxford University Hospital's National Health Service Foundation Trust. He is the current clinical lead for emergency general surgery and the clinical lead for surgical site infection reduction strategies within the Oxfordshire Trust, as well as being a governor of the Trust. Giles graduated from University College Hospital in London and decided on a career in general surgery. He trained in London, mainly working at University College Hospital, the Royal Free Hospital, St. Bartholomew's Hospital, and the Royal London Hospital. He also travelled abroad to gain laparoscopic hepatobiliary experience at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester in the United States. Giles was a competitive diver right up until he went to medical school, when he dived into his studies. He tells me that he's now a prolific gamer so that he can keep up with his two boys who are 11 and 12 years old. Giles Bond-Smith, welcome to the podcast.
Jonathan, thank you so much. Those great words. Very kind.
You're very welcome. You know, you and I were talking before we got going about some of our experiences and some of the things we've read. And I think this podcast could go in many interesting directions. But I'd like to start. We'll share with the audience. We, you know, whenever surgeons get together, it's inevitable that they'll talk about interesting papers they've read. And I'm going to try and think of a way if I can reference this. And if I can't reference it in this podcast, I'll get you back and we'll do it again. But it was very funny. I'm still laughing about it. So, Giles, I left the UK when I was a senior registrar to take up a post at Cedars-Sinai and UCLA in Los Angeles many, many moons ago. My impressions of America, impacted me. I'd like to know what your general impressions of American medicine were for the 3 months you were over there, compared to what you saw as a trainee over here and what you now know.
Yeah, do you know, it was really exciting times, actually. You know, I was a trainee in London, looking at HPB and liver transplant was my focus at that point. And I've been lucky enough to get a fellowship, a traveling fellowship via the Cutler's Livery Company, to go over and visit the this amazing surgeon called Mike Kendrick. And I tell you, it taught me a lot, actually. The one thing I would say is teamwork seems to be super important over in America. There was a real sense of belonging and being part of a team. Do you know what? I don't know how you find this, Jonathan, but I really do feel that the juniors, the F1 grades and the CT grades in today's NHS perhaps just don't have that feeling of belonging to a team anymore. You know?
Yeah, I was, as I say, I left as an SR over here, and when I came back, I've done a little bit of volunteer work during the pandemic, and seeing training and seeing attitudes to training, I would say America is more hierarchical in regards to the training. The residents are certainly a lot more, I won't say respectful is not quite the right word, but they that's something I think the Americans get right in terms of the training, and it's far more, it's very well organized. Let's leave it at that. What do you say?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where I was going to go. It's part of being a team. It's ruthlessly efficient. And at the end of the day, they do not hang around to discuss possibilities of making things better. As soon as they've got the evidence behind something, any innovation, any change in practice that could potentially make things better, and it's demonstrably safe, then they rapidly implement that and analyze the impact it has. If it works, it stays. And if it doesn't, it's culled relatively quickly. And it just seems to be very, very efficient.
I 100% agree with that. You know, we have fallen into a behavior pattern that we want to dissect the data. And, you know, the classic is you see a small trial which shows statistically significant differences. Small trial, let's say 10 patients in each arm. The response from the audience will be, you need a bigger trial. If that's the case, why the heck do we bother with statistics? I agree with you. We should use the best evidence today, continue to audit our practice, and amend as necessary. But that's not what we do. We wait and wait and wait. Meanwhile, patients, you know, potentially suffer. How do we make it better, Giles?
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? Leadership. That's what you need. You need people to stand up, be willing to take responsibility for the decisions they make and implement, and also empower those leaders to actually be able to make effective change. Because, Jonathan, how many times have you been involved in meetings where at the end of the meeting, the only conclusion is, we need another meeting?
Or a subcommittee. You're absolutely right.
You know,
drives me up the bloody wall. Exactly. Actually, I'll give you a funny example. I won't mention which institution, but I had the audacity to go off on a holiday. When I came back, I discovered that I had been put on to the operating theatre committee, which, you know, there's a lesson here. Never go on vacation or they'll give you some. So I go to my first meeting, and the first item in the first meeting was about start times. We were supposed to put knife to skin at 7:30. The average knife to skin time was 8:24. They had organized a subcommittee of the operating theatre committee, and their conclusions were that the way to solve this problem was to move the start time to 8:30. That was my shortest committee appointment ever. I stood up and I said, this is like Monty Python. I'm out of here.
I know. I sit on numerous meetings purely because I believe you can't complain about something unless you're in there trying to affect change, right? And so I do get it heavily involved in various projects, but it just drives me insane when I collect a load of data, present the data, the solution takes so long in coming that I get asked, well, this data is now out of date. Can we please get up to date data, right? And you're there, but this is never going to get solved because a decision can't be made within a meaningful time frame. And I think that the Americans just don't do that, whereas the UK is so paralyzed by making a wrong decision, no decision is made, and that in actual fact is worse than making possibly a poor decision, you know?
So look, my suggestion is that, and this is very self-serving, that you doing something like this, doing a podcast that potentially reaches a massive audience and being outspoken, but, you know, doing it with the right intention to improve the quality of care is the way to go, because everything that we do in camera, Chatham House rule and all that, goes nowhere. You know, in my opinion, Britain's got a lot of things right during the COVID-19 pandemic, vaccinations and so on, much better than the United States. But the National Health Service has been placed under intense pressure at this time, and the impact on elective surgeries and treatments has been profound. So let's use that as an example of taking leadership. I'm going to appoint you Grand Poobah. You're in charge of the National Health Service now. What would you do to change the implementation of elective treatments?
So I tell you what, I'm going to draw a theme out here, because one of my interests, as you know, Jonathan, is surgical site infection reduction strategies, right? Now, listen, if you think about it, that the average patient that gets a surgical site infection, and there are different grades of surgical site infection, but the average patient with a surgical site infection stays in hospital an extra 5 to 6 days, right? Now, we're approaching 10 to 13 million backlog of sort of operations. If you could reduce surgical site infections, which is up in the top of the hospital-acquired infections, just think, you'd be saving 5 to 6 days per infection. And for all of those infections, you're suddenly looking at freeing up tens of thousands of bed days, all of which can be used to rapidly turn over more cases. And we've got solutions here in Oxford, and, you know, I speak around the UK, which are free. You know, these things are, everybody does, it's just how they do it. And I think you've got to start looking outside of the box in terms of how do we maximize the efficiency of a bed in the NHS. And the one way you've got to do that is by reducing post-op complications. There's no good just trying to thrash people through in a haphazard way, because we'd never do that. But you've got to get it right first time. It's a big buzz phrase in the NHS. You've got to work the patient up properly, make sure they're optimized, ensure that the operation is carried out to the highest levels, taking into account SSI reduction strategies, and then getting the patient home quickly via an enhanced recovery program and minimizing the morbidity postoperatively. It sounds simple, right?
Well, we're going to dig down more into the SSI, the surgical site infection topic, in a bit, but I just want to continue on this theme. It's about big thinking. Instead of thinking about, things like colonoscopies, getting colonoscopies, routine colonoscopies done in an expedient fashion. I was chatting to a GP friend of mine who said he's got over 100 patients waiting for a colonoscopy. You know for a fact, if one of those people has a cancer, waiting a year makes a hell of a difference to their chances of survival. So it's about having a sort of, a horizon scanning approach to how can we resolve this? Because my bet is our colleagues are good, caring people. If you say, here's a problem, why don't you be part of the solution? When I was an SR at the Hammersmith, we had a backlog. So my fellow SRs and I got together and we said, you know what, why don't we do an endoscopy list over the weekend? And, you know, it'd be great for us. We'll get to do loads of colonoscopies and, you know, get even better at them. And within a course of a few weeks, there was no backlog. Yeah. And we made it open access for the local general practitioners, so they didn't have to go through a palaver to get people seen. So, you know, if a GP says, I'm concerned this patient may be at risk for, you know, a serious colorectal disease, can you scope them? Bang, done.
Exactly. And the thing is that everybody can do that so long as there's an end in sight. You know, people don't mind stepping up. If you looked at the COVID, the NHS as a whole, in the first year, everybody stepped up. Everybody worked way longer hours than they were meant to do. Everybody came in, what can I do? How can I help? But that can't go on for 30 years, if you see what I mean. Then you have to change into these sort of different ways of working. One of the things I would say, Jonathan, is the NHS, and this is with my emergency surgery hat on, we do slightly silly things now and then. Let's just take hot gallbladders, right? Patient comes in with infected gallbladder. Laparoscopic cholecystectomy is required. What do we do? Send them home with antibiotics and book them for an elective operation in 3 months' time, by and large, right? Why aren't we, when they come in, treating them there and then? And what we saw in Oxford when we changed the pathway so that we went from doing about 80 hot gallbladders a year to sort of 350 to 400 hot gallbladders a year is that those patients don't trouble us again.
Yeah, they don't come back in with an obstructed common bile duct or empyema. Yeah.
Or recurrent pancreatitis.
Yes.
I'm using that as one example, but there are hundreds of examples across surgery and medicine where actually if a patient attends, sort them there and then. And I guess we need to try and sort of move more into that way, because that would be your colonoscopy, right? Someone turns up with abnormal bowel habit, change in mucus and blood or whatever coming, they're going to be high risk. But a 40-year-old with maybe a little bit of fresh bleeding once on the, it's a different person. So we need better stratification. We need better early diagnostics. I'll talk about that a bit later, in helping to get the high risk patients seen very, very quickly and the low risks seen within a timely frame manner. Do you see what I mean?
It all makes perfect sense. You know, if you look at the Veterans Administration in the United States, where, you know, there is a, shall we say, a certain lugubrious element to the way that people go through the treatment paradigm, we'd see the same thing. The patient with the, you know, the bothersome gallstones, biliary colic, was eventually coming back really, really sick because there was such a delay to getting them treated. So it's not rocket science. You've mentioned diagnostics. So look, here in the UK, we've done, as I said, I'm really impressed with the vaccination thing. I'm fully vaccinated and I've got the pass on my phone, and anyone needs to see it, bang, I pull it up. My American friends have a little piece of cardboard that says they've been vaccinated, and it's not well organized. And, you know, people who wanted a vaccine went and got it, and other people who should have had a vaccine didn't get a notification. It's a bit of a mess. But why don't we do a better job with things like our results? I mean, I've been trying to help a friend navigate a serious illness, and his GP never gets notification from the consultant. The hospital are never in touch. It's just a bloody mess. How do we do that better? Make it efficient, bring together patient, doctors, and data in an expedient manner. It should be possible in 2021.
It is, actually. And in our surgical emergency unit here in Oxford, we are virtually all digital now. So there's very, very little in the way of paper notes. And the beauty about that is it means that the junior doctors, when they're doing discharge summaries, can drag results and CT scans, blood results, and also type a comprehensive, the patient came in with this, we did X, they need Y, and that will be done in a meaningful time frame. And that paperwork gets emailed the same day the patient goes home to the GP, and the patient gets a copy, a paper copy of it, to go home as well. Now, when I took over the, you know, when I first came to Oxford 5-6 years ago, we were at about 20% doing patients getting their discharge summary accurately written within 24 hours of the patient leaving the hospital. We're now well over 95%, right? So it is working because we've digitalized. So we can just automatically suck in blood results, you know, CT scans, imaging, and endoscopy results into the discharge summary. What we have to do, though, is we have to be mindful that doctors' language amongst themselves can be incredibly alarming for patients. So there has to be incredible focus on communication between doctor-doctor, doctor-nurse, doctor-allied health professional communication and doctor-patient communication, so that the wrong end of the stick is not picked up by the patient and we end up terrifying them. And we just about start a big project looking at how we communicate now, not just with the patient, but there's another group, the patient's family, the patient's relatives. Because actually, if you're sending a 90-year-old, maybe slightly confused patient home, who actually needs to know what the hell's going on? It's not the patient necessarily, it's the carers, it's the family, as well as the GP. So we're looking about how we can bring that all in together.
Yeah, I think you and I are going to have to get together over a glass of wine and discuss all of this, because I think you're right, and it needs vocal people who are in leadership positions in clinics say, this isn't good enough, we need to do better. And look, let's face it, hospitals are dangerous places to be with nosocomial infections, decubitus ulcers, falls, impaired sleep, and so on. So keeping people out of hospital more effectively is that's also sensible, right?
Of course it is. And do you know, how about this? This is where teamwork and leadership comes together. Because on my unit, although it's a surgical emergency unit, we don't just have surgeons and nurses. We have our periop team, who are a crack team of a care of the elderly, acute physicians that specialize in getting surgical patients home safely and quickly. So they're engaged in the patient's admission right at the beginning, immediately assessing all the medications that the patients are on. Are they useful? Are they up to date? Are there alternatives? Optimizing the patient quickly before an operation, and then helping us make sure that the patient gets mobilized home safely, and integrating all the support services, occupational therapy, physio, the care at home, rapidly. And do you know what? That allows the surgical team more time to focus on their area of expertise, which is actually in theatre and dealing with the complex surgical problems post-operatively. That requires a lot of communication. It requires clear leaders, which I have to say in America, as you said, Jonathan, it's very hierarchical, but at least in that kind of system, you know exactly who the leader is. I'm going to go to him because he or she is understanding and running the team. And at all of that still requires to bring the family on board and say, right, are we all up to speed with what happened here? They came in with A, we did B, they're going home with C. And you've got to make it as simple and as clear as possible. Otherwise, confusion gets set in. And once patients and family members get confused, then care suffers and complaints come.
So I fly aeroplanes for my avocation. And I know that, there was this wonderful book, Complications by Atul Gawande. And I always think, you know, he wrote the book I always wanted to write. I'm glad he wrote it because I would nowhere near have done the job he did. But in aviation, we have call and response. The things that we've done by imposing very clear communication has improved aviation safety dramatically. And I don't know why some in our profession are resistant. I want to come on to a topic I know is very dear to your heart, SSI. And I just want to reference again a problem that we have in medicine about negative results. Many years ago, I ran a multi-center trial that compared two antibiotic regimes with the same drug for preoperative elective colorectal surgery. It was a good-sized cohort, and the final data showed, surprise, surprise, no difference between one or three doses. And it changed my thinking about surgical site infections, SSIs. I'd like to talk to you about your strategies to reduce these, but first maybe giving us a good definition to work with so we're comparing apples to apples and how common they are nowadays. And the reason I referenced my trial experience was I couldn't get the damn thing published forever because journals were saying, well, you know, your infection rate's quite high. Well, it turned out that it wasn't my infections. It was a multi-center study across the UK. Turns out it was a very honest paper. People didn't kind of like that. They wanted happy, slappy, clappy news. So first of all, define SSIs for us. And how common are they nowadays?
Oh, Jonathan, I knew you were going to ask me about definitions in SSIs. I work with two fantastic professors, a guy called Professor Leeper, who spent his life looking at SSIs, and another professor called Professor Maria Bormeister from the Netherlands, who's involved in the World Health Organization looking at SSI reduction strategies. And do you know what? Every time we get together, we turn around and say, we've got to have a better definition than what we've got at the moment, because it's really, really difficult to define exactly what we mean by a surgical site infection. If you take the CDC classification or the Public Health England classification, which are very, very similar, you've got incisional type infections, so superficial or deep, so that's the skin going down to it. Let's take the abdominal wall, for example, the skin going down to the rectus sheath, then that's a deep incision, right? Or if you've got an intra-abdominal collection, then it would be organ space. So we call it A, B, C, so superficial, deep, or organ space incisional infections. But when you look at the detail in that, there's actually quite a lot of markers within each of those definitions as exactly what makes a superficial and what makes a deep, right? And I could talk for half a day on the definitions of that. But the get out of jail card that they all have is actually an incision, an incisional infection, a surgical site infection is whatever a clinician says it is. And that's just awful. I just don't agree with that at all. And that's where we're trying to sort of really rethink what is a surgical site infection. For the listeners out there at the moment, I would wholeheartedly recommend the CDC classification. But when you in your own departments are trying to monitor your SSI rate, you need only one or two people who are going to agree exactly what is a superficial, deep or organ space infection. Otherwise, you end up with 10, 12 people within your department all trying to do the same job and all coming up with different results. So I appreciate you asked for a definition, Jonathan. It's really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, as you know, you'd have situations where someone's got a red wound and some people would call that an infection and some people say, well, there's no bugs cultured. You know, yeah, but you didn't look for them. You'd have to make a hole to stick a bloody swab in to ascertain if there is, if there are bugs in the wound. So the definition is important. But, you know, you mentioned the waiting list in the UK now because of COVID, and you said that if we were to reduce SSIs, we could save bed days and get through the waiting list faster. So what percentage, well, let's take elective colorectal surgery. What are the honest rates of SSIs? I mean, I think I know the answer, but I'd love to hear it from the mouth of an expert.
Well, so, okay, so let me, I'm going to say straight out that how many people, hand on heart, can tell me their 30-day SSI rate, or if there's a mesh or a prosthesis put in, their one-year SSI rate. And by and large, it's double what the journals publish is the actual finding. In the audit that I did in Oxford when I first turned up in our HPB department, the published literature in HPB surgery says that there's about 30 to 40% SSI rate. That was found to be about 60, 65% when we looked at our 30-day rate. And when I've gone around to other HPB departments, it's hovered around 60 to 65% without any, virgin analysis, if you see what I mean. As soon as you introduce a bundle, you can massively reduce it. In colorectal surgery, it's pretty heterogeneous, because what do you mean by colorectal surgery? Do you mean open, laparoscopic, robotic? Do you mean with a primary anastomosis, leaving a stoma? All of those things vary, but it's between 5 and 15%. It's around that kind of mark in colorectal surgery. But do you know what there's a paper that's just been published actually by Professor Leeper that says, and this is using American Medicaid insurance databases, massive database, and they've come out with a figure that a deep or organ space surgical site infection costs an extra $110,000. Can you imagine if you didn't have that, how much you would save?
Oh, absolutely. Again, it's like putting the patient at the center of all we do and doing the best we know based on the data that we know today will invariably lead to better care. And if you do better care, you'll save money. I mean, it's like, whether it's, you know, tight glycemic control or ideal treatment of angina or incipient myocardial ischemia, it doesn't matter. If it's a stroke, if you have a brain attack unit and you initiate therapy early, you don't have someone who's going to be on a stroke unit for 3 months. So it all makes perfect sense.
It does. And do you know, Jonathan, if you get an SSI, there is a 60% higher chance you'll require critical care postoperatively at some point, right? It doubles your chance of mortality, for example. I mean, that's just unbelievable, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, let's come on to the concept of a bundle of care. So Peter Pronovost initiated that concept for catheter-related bloodstream infections, something I did work on years ago. And I believe you've got a similar approach. And the publication you referenced, I've actually got it here in front of me with David Leeper in the Journal of Wound Care. You've mentioned some of the salient points. Anything you'd like to tell us about the bundle of care?
Yeah. So here's where this all came from. It was a great guy that I work with, and he's a mentor of mine, Mr. Sunawala, who you'll see on that, who's named on that paper as well. And what we're really looking for in a bundle is effectively marginal gain theorem. So the sum of the individual parts together is greater than the sum of the individual parts, if that makes sense. And we wanted to try and put together some sort of evidence-based bundle that was cheap, easily implementable, and not controversial. So straight away, Jonathan, I, as an HBB surgeon, are not coming to you as a colorectal surgeon telling you how to do your anastomosis. I don't care whether you do a hand-sewn, two-layer, stapled, whatever you want to do. The best operation you do is the operation you know how to do best, right? So all the evidence looking at the actual operative strategies, we shied away from because it was going to be too controversial and you wouldn't get surgical buy-in. And we needed that right from the beginning. The other thing is that in this bundle, we wanted it to be reliable, robustly done every single time for every patient. So it can't be more than 10 points, we felt. And we split those 10 points into 5 pre-op and 5 on closing. And the issue with that is, well, who's responsible for each part? And then you give each part to just one person. So the correct antibiotics at the correct time given to the anaesthetist. Clipping, not shaving the patient, you give that to the junior, the CT grade. Warming, we made sure that the nurses on the ward and the operating department assistants were responsible for ensuring the patient stayed warm. That's all. And each person of the team then just have one job to do. They all are easily able to do it. And it means that overall, the bundle was implemented really efficiently every single time. And the results were just phenomenal, if I'm honest. And it didn't take that much to get the team together.
Yeah, and listen, I've been involved in a project looking at patient warming, and it's such an easy thing to do. You know, as you say, when you look at these individual things and add them all up, you make a big difference. And, you know, when people say, yeah, but it's only a 1% change, it's like, yes, that's your patient. That's your patient. Do your very, very best. You wouldn't turn up to do an operation having had a night out on the tiles. For an elective procedure, you'd want to be well rested.
Exactly. And I tell you, it was quite funny that the neurosurgeons, when we were talking to them about SSI reduction strategies, they turned around and said, but our strategy, you know, our SSI rate, which they actually did know, was about 3%. It was 3.4%. Well, we won't get lower than that. When they introduced the bundle, they dropped it to 1.4%. That's over a 50% reduction. Isn't that fantastic? You know, it's just amazing that in a group of individuals that had a low rate, felt that they couldn't do any better, but with just a real team mentality and a structured approach, got a further 50% reduction.
Yeah.
But for no cost, we're not talking about introducing big, expensive, negative pressure therapy dressings and all this kind of stuff. We're not asking for any of that. It's asking to do the basics and get it right every time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, I know that we're trained to be skeptics. It's a good thing. It stops us flip-flopping all over the place. And I know that, I mentioned an antibiotic trial I did. In the early days of laparoscopy, things I endeavored to disseminate were dismissed by the institutions, if you will, because it was new. And one of the best comments was, there's no reference data in your references. That's because there wasn't any. You reference something, for goodness sake. Your work makes such eminent good sense. And we've already said could save lives, could save money. Other than publishing papers in peer-reviewed journals that will be read by a small number of people, and you're largely preaching to the choir, how are you? We've talked about leadership. Come on, Giles, how are you going to get people on board and say, stop mucking about, do this?
Yeah, so I travel and I meet people face-to-face. It's been difficult over the last couple of years, and it's not the same about doing it online, but actually you turn up, you meet one or two, one or two people that have a vague interest, and you get them excited. You explain to them how easy it is for them to affect change, to improve patient outcome, especially in HPB, because in HPB surgery, if I do a great big Whipple's operation, or someone undergoes pancreatic cancer resection surgery, right? The whole success of that operation needs post-operative chemotherapy. If they've got a big wound infection, they'll miss their optimal time to chemotherapy, and it negates the operation that they've had. So HPB surgeons really buy in the same way that colorectal and all the other specialties do as well. Joint, I mean, imagine you get your hip infected. And that's just catastrophic for a patient. So the orthopedic surgeons are all over this to try and avoid that happening in the first place. But they need a simple solution. You give them evidence-based. So there is evidence that the correct antibiotics at the correct time. There's evidence that normothermia, normoglycemia, clipping, not shaving. And I present all this evidence, right? But it's only for 5 points pre-op, okay? So they can remember it and they can see how easy it is to just do it every time. And when you go around, they go, I hear this all the time, Jonathan. Yeah, but Giles, we already do that. And actually, when you go and independently assess these units, do you know what? The patient's not 36 degrees or above. They're actually, at the time of knife to skin, they're at 35.7. That makes a difference. You know, the antibiotics, slightly forgot to give the antibiotics. I just gave them 20 minutes after the knife to skin. You know, that's not the right time. And then you look at the antibiotics that they're given, and they're not the antibiotics that that local population should be getting. And it's about just tightening up all these little bits so that, you know what, they do it, but they just got to do it slightly better and demonstrably every time. Now, me as an individual can't do that. You as an individual can't do that. And that's where you need a really strong team to come together so that everybody does their one job every time.
You know, I think you're bang on target with that, Giles, but I would suggest there's another team member that you need to get on board, and that's the patient. Patients need to know that it's kind of like with COVID, patients know that they expect to see their doctor washing their hands, not touching their face and wearing a mask, right? The things they've been told to do. So getting patients on board, you know, we need to see you on Good Morning America and Good Morning Britain talking about this and educating the world.
Yeah. Prehabilitation, Jonathan. That's what you're talking about, my friend.
Absolutely.
I don't know what you think about that word. I'm not really, it doesn't quite do it for me, but I get what they mean. Prehabilitation, enhanced recovery post-op. It's about making the patient the center of their own care. They've got to take responsibility. After the operation, they've got to get up, moving, deep breathing. Before the operation, trying to stop smoking, lose weight, make sure that their diabetes is under control, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they've got to take ownership for the process they're about to go through. But you can only do that with good communication from the doctors and from the nurses and from all the other allied health professionals. You know?
Well, here's a stupid thought. I mean, I like writing about stuff, and I was writing about food and diets and such like, and I'm going to do a podcast on it at some point in the future. But one thing struck me: we are taught precious little about food and diets at university, at medical school. We're also taught precious little about how to communicate. And maybe that's something that the deans of medical schools could think about. But I, you know, Giles, I always like to ask my guests some version of this, because sadly we're running out of time. And I love to close by asking my guests some version of this question. If you came across a genie, and after releasing this magical creature from the bottle, you were offered 3 wishes, what would your wishes be?
Cool. Okay. Well, for me, the first wish has to be time. I want more time, Jonathan, because there's a lot to get done and I just need more time to get it done. The second thing is I would love everybody to be able to have the ability to communicate their own thoughts to all the individuals that they come across. So give the people power of communication, because it's all very well, you and I are having this conversation because we're on a podcast now, right? But if you and I were chatting over a bit, we'd be having we'd be using different language. If I was talking to a confused person, I'd be having different language again. If I'm talking to a nurse or occupational therapist or speech and language therapist, I'd be using different language again. People don't understand how important clear communication is. And for that, I would really like my second wish to be giving everybody the ability to clearly communicate their own thoughts to the person in front of them. And then I guess my third thought would be, my third wish, if I had one, would be a cure to biofilm. If you could knock biofilm on the head tomorrow, our SSI problems would disappear.
Yeah, I did some, it's a great one. I was involved years ago in a project looking at antibiotic impregnated central venous catheters, and the data were level one evidence, multiple trials showing that the darn things worked. Could we get people to use them?
Well, I've just sat on the NICE Medical Technology Advisories Committee looking at antibiotic impregnated sutures. I mean, these things have been around for 20, 30 years. And yet we NICE have only just done an independent evaluation of all the literature. And guess what they've come out with? These things work. I mean, they've worked for years. But the problem is there's so much misinformation and skepticism that actually it's taken until now for NICE to and even NICE didn't do it. They got an external auditory committee to come along and look at all the information independently. And these things work. And these are the innovations, Jonathan. I mean, we're talking about SSI here, but there'll be innovations in medications. There'll be innovations in anesthetic, in nursing care, in wound care, beds. You know, why do we, you know, are the beds that we have, the mattresses? I've seen some fantastic innovations. We've just got to be able to get them implemented quicker. And I have to say, America, and it really should hold its head high because it's generally very good at getting that done.
Well, yes, invention and innovation are two very different things. Mm. And I think people need to think about that. Giles, one thing is apparent. We need to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your perspective. Absolutely fascinating.
Jonathan, I look forward to it. But can we do it in the evening next time so we can have a glass of red?
Well, yeah, but I think we'll you know, something could be a very interesting conversation if we had two glasses. Folks, that's it for today. Please, Giles, just what a wonderful conversation. Folks, please join us next week for the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Jonathan Sakian. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.